Hello and welcome to Root Causes, the PKI and Security Podcast, where two digital certificate industry veterans talk about PKI, authentication, identity, encryption, and all matters of digital certificates and PKI. This is episode 14. I am joined by Jason Sirocco. Jason is the CTO of IoT at Sectigo, and I am Tim Callen. I'm a senior fellow here at Sectigo. Welcome, Jay.
Hey, Tim.
So today we are talking about a recently breaking news item. This first came to my attention from Krebs on Security, where Brian Krebs reports on a security researcher. I have the name here, Paul Maripesi. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right, Paul. Send me an email if I'm not, and we'll correct the record. But Paul Maripesi revealed a security flaw in a large number. We're talking about millions of consumer products that involve the iLink P2P software that comes out of Shenzhen Uni Technology in China. And these are consumer products. It's things like baby monitors, webcams, smart doorbells. And basically, the gist of the problem, as reported, is that all of these devices, they have no authentication, they have no encryption, and they can be easily enumerated. So, Jay, first of all, before we go any further, what does this easily enumerated word mean?
If you have devices on a network, let's say your own home network,
right?
The ability to list out what is on your network is something that you might be able to log into your router management software. And that management software in the router is giving you a list of everything that's on the network. And it's doing that by enumerating all the different devices that are connecting to it. So okay. In other words, taking inventory of what is connected.
Right. So why is that a problem from a security perspective?
If you're enumeratable, that means that somebody knows you're out there. And if a bad guy wants to know that you're there, then being enumeratable makes it easier. That in itself is not a problem, because when you connect to public Wi-Fi access points,
right,
you're obviously enumeratable with your iPhone, your Android device, or your PC, whatever you're connecting with.
Sure.
So in other words, being listed somewhere, being enumerated, is not really a problem. It's when you don't have any authentication or any encryption, all of a sudden, not only do people know who you are, the fact that you're connected, you might even be broadcasting things such as, hey, I'm using iLink to P2P technology. Right. And I've got a humongous flaw that you've just read about on Krebs.
Right, please. I have a big giant gap in my security. Why don't you walk through it? Right. So it's like, I get it. So the enumeration, the point about enumeration basically is that not only are these flawed devices, but they're very easily discoverable. So if you want to exploit this technology, not only do you know how to exploit it, but you know how to find the devices to exploit.
Exactly right.
So we heard there's no authentication, there's no encryption. These are consumer devices. What are the ways that they might be exploited?
You know, I think on a previous podcast, we ran through a lot of this, which is once you're enumerated, once people know what kind of a protocol or technology that you're actually working with, typically the flaw can be then taken advantage of. But that's right. Not really the point to the fact that you can be enumerated. The fact that enumeration was noted as part of this, you know, this issue is the fact that something like a Mirai botnet or any right. of the many, many variants can take advantage of that. This would essentially enable the mass exploitation of all of these devices that have a vulnerable technology. That is the point to talking about enumeration. If you're enumeratable and also you have a massive flaw within your security technology, or if you have absolutely no security technology whatsoever, then these botnet harvesters, you're making their lives really, really easy.
Yeah, and of course, the Mirai botnet is the obvious example to come up here, but there have been many such and multiple attacks. And so, again, what are the kinds of criminal activities that are enabled by botnets, and why should we care?
Sure. Probably one of the most obvious ones, if we remember back to, you know, the original Mirai botnet variants and what they were doing, if you're able to have tens of thousands or perhaps millions of devices under your control,
right,
the ability to then send packets from those devices to a destination that destination can get very, very easily overwhelmed by millions and millions of devices essentially pinged. And there are various levels in the IP stack that can be taken advantage of to make not very costly packet formations that are emitted by these devices that can cost a very resource-intensive response. And that's when you have essentially a denial of service attack.
Yeah, I remember when these massive DDoS attacks came out. I'm going to say it was like summer of 2016. Am I getting that right? These DDoS attacks that were just an order of magnitude bigger than anyone had ever seen before. And that's exactly what it was, right? It was large numbers of IoT devices that were essentially unsecured that were being owned by these botnet, farm owners in order to perpetuate exactly these kinds of attacks.
There's nothing new here, Tim. This is what's amazing to me is,
right.
The original Mirai botnet was really about talking about, again, no authentication, no encryption. In the previous podcast where we talked about IoT security, we talked about things like static credentials and symmetric tokens and those very, very weak forms of authentication. But look, you know, Krebs still has articles talking about utterly zero security. Not even really a flaw. It's wrong to call this a hack or a flaw. There's simply no security whatsoever. This is exactly why legislation's coming about. And it's specifically noting, not just, hey, throw some security at it. It's specifically noting the lack of identity-based security to be able to have, you know, strong mutual authentication and some sort of an identifier so that, yeah, of course you could be enumeratable, but you know, something like a very weak form of Mirai botnet should not be able to just harvest you as part of a botnet and then move on with so little friction.
Yeah, and it's not just DDoS attacks, right? It's all kinds of things. People can use this to perpetuate large-scale phishing. They can use it to crunch, like let's say they're trying to break some cryptography if you have lots and lots of processors at your availability. They can use it for Bitcoin harvesting. There's lots of ways that somebody, when they own a whole bunch of processors and a whole bunch of bandwidth, can do things that aren't really in the general public's good.
Tim, let's talk about another form of enumeration for a moment, and where it's even scarier than, you know, some off-the-shelf, you know, low-cost device that that we're talking about right now.
Right.
There was a project that started a while back called the Shodan search engine. And those of you in the security business, you know, you either know about it or you've probably heard about it. But they've done an amazing job of enumerating all sorts of technology stacks for IoT, connected IoT devices. And what it really shows is, first of all, the myth of air gap. In other words, there are tens of thousands, if not more, controller devices in critical infrastructure today that are exposed to the public internet.
Yeah.
And the Shodan search engine is looking for, you know, it's basically enumerating all the public nodes on the internet, looking for specific technologies that are known to be, you know, industrial controller devices or things like that. What's this? I think one of the scariest maps I had ever seen was a list of controller devices. And I'm not including just closed circuit television cameras and those kinds of things, which quite often can be connected to the public internet. I'm talking about things that really should be behind an industrial firewall, but aren't. The Shodan search engine showed a map of where they were able to enumerate these things. And it literally was a map of the entire world that has electricity.
Yeah. Yeah. So, by the way, just for the listeners, that's Shodan, Shodan.io. So you can actually, you can go there and play with the tools. So that's a good thing for us to share for people who aren't familiar with it. So, right. So this kind of attack, obviously, we think a lot about these big sort of, what do I want to call it? These heavy artillery sort of attacks like DDoS, but it's also bad for the individual consumer who owns the device. Wouldn't you agree?
Sure. If we're talking about baby monitors, if we're talking about IP cameras, you know, you might not mind the fact that your front door, you know, where you might have a camera, might be viewed by somebody on the internet. But on the other hand, that camera might be in a more private place in your house. And we've heard about things like people talking to babies on a baby monitor, you know, goodness knows where the voice is coming from, but it's a hack.
Or no, someone uses it to figure out that you're not home before they come burglarize your house. Or someone uses it to capture images that they then publish that you wouldn't necessarily want published. Absolutely.
From a privacy standpoint, obvious risks. And then we start to get into the, you know, some other even, you know, more terrible things, which is all sorts of automated garage door openers, et cetera.
Right.
Those kinds of things that can give access to a house. But then you don't have to have a lot of creativity to realize search the Shodan search engine. And those controller devices, which you might think are highly secured, really all the reason why those devices are connected to the public internet is because most of those devices have a built-in web server, which has been exposed to the public internet, typically for the ease of use of connectivity for somebody not having to traverse a firewall or VPN in. And quite often, it's just a username and password. It's just a static credential to get in. And the worst part is there are a certain percentage of those devices where you just know it's going to be the same default username password that came from the factory, you know, something like admin.
Yeah. And password theft is also another scenario there. So even in the event that the end user is able to change the password, which you may or may not be able to do, we all know that in the real world, passwords get reused. And so password theft becomes another avenue of attack. I get your password to your seemingly innocuous device. You go, who really cares if they know if my refrigerator is running? But then you use that to also get the password to the alarm system, let's say. And now it really matters.
If you take a look at quote from the story, ILNK PNP to P2P devices offer no authentication or encryption.
Right.
The or encryption part, you might think, well, maybe there's sensitive data going across the wire that can be sniffed. Well, part of that sensitive information is going to be those static credentials,
whether
it is the symmetric token or the username and password. Those things are being passed in the clear and therefore are, I mean, that's about as simple as possible. Even if the thing did have credentials, even if it did have a username and password, even if it wasn't a static username and password, it was changed every day, it wouldn't matter. The bad guy could get in.
Right. And then furthermore, just to exacerbate the problem, in the event that those are standardized credentials, you know, if I steal one that's passed in the clear, it may give me access to tens of thousands of devices using that one password.
You got it.
Yeah. So you alluded to legislation, and I think that's an interesting point. Is that legislation? We know California has passed a bill, and I think we know there's a lot more on the way. In other states and also at the national level, what will that do? How will that help?
The California legislation very specifically is a reaction to the Mirai botnet. And that has to do with, very, very specifically named in the legislation, is the ability to change the username and password. In other words, it's a ban against static username and passwords that cannot be changed. That is all the California legislation is at this
point. So that helps a little, but if they're shipping with the default set of static credentials, and if we think that most consumers won't change them, the California legislation is far from a panacea for this kind of problem.
And if it doesn't have TLS encrypted sessions, in other words, if it doesn't have an encrypted communication session, that username and password you just changed is going to be in the clear.
This really needs to be solved at the manufacturer level, right? I mean, this needs to go back to the people who are producing these devices in mass have the ability at that time to put strong authentication, encryption, and proper credentials, right, key-based credentials on these devices. And that is really where this needs to get solved. Am I right?
Yes, it does. So if you're an enterprise that runs these kinds of devices, mm-hmm. you need to be going even further than just waiting for legislation to save you. you need to be talking to the vendors about, and essentially have to vote with your dollars. And that means by having large enterprises can do this kind of thing, to be able to have procurement language that specifies, hey, you know, all this static credential problem, there's no way in 2019, 2020, I'm going to be putting a device, you know, on my factory floor, on my automation, you know, operational systems, where, you know, my devices essentially have either no security or some sort of static credential. That's just not acceptable anymore. And you should put in your procurement language that you want something that's a lot stronger than that.
Right. So the enterprise, that makes great sense, because they understand the stakes. They have the purchasing power to force this requirement. And we have educated professionals. It strikes me that consumer devices are a little more of an intractable problem, that your average consumer is probably not going to put security on the top of the list. And they're probably not, there probably will be few of them that will actually make a choice based on security. Maybe if it's a garage door or a home alarm system, more so. But if it's a toy, I'm skeptical that a lot of consumers will do this. I'm thinking about the toys that I own for my own son that connect to the internet, and I don't actually know how secure they are, because it just never struck me as a high priority. So that seems like a little bit of a, that's going to be a longer march to get that one solved, don't you think?
If I had children and I had toys for them that were connected to the internet, I'd be quite wary of it. I know that a lot of people, it's funny how things have changed, where people are more than happy to put a lot of private information into the internet now through social media.
Right.
You know, people are happy to buy things like Amazon Alexa and Echo devices, Dot devices, all those things that listen to you. Those are potential privacy issues. And if you look at information on the internet, there definitely have been problems surrounding those things. You know, it's kind of interesting how consumers may not fear it as much as perhaps they should, but that's a fickle vertical consumer. I definitely think you're right that the price sensitivity of the vendors, even to spend, you know, 50 cents to 10 cents to 1 cent for some kind of security on a device is maybe too much. But I also suspect from that standpoint, they just want to get the product to market fast. And they're not thinking about it too much at all.
Absolutely. Right. You're buying off-the-shelf component parts. You're putting them together in some kind of a shell. These component parts are coming standard. You actually get a better price if you don't customize them. So you're buying the standard things as much as you can. Plus, you can plug them right in. They're available immediately. Supply chain is easier. There are all these motivators that kind of get away from building a premium security product. I wonder if at the end of the day, consumer education is a huge necessary component of this, to say, hey, that item that you might not be thinking about might actually be presenting a security risk for you, and maybe you do want to vote with your dollars.
If you think about credit cards, I think everybody's credit card's been stolen at least 5 times now.
Right.
I might be exaggerating a little, but maybe not that much.
Not a lot.
You know, so if fraud of identity, you know, your social insurance numbers, your credit card numbers, I think people are quite used to now being on closed circuit television when they walk down the street.
Sure.
Perhaps people are starting to get used to the idea of being monitored 24/7 by a company out of California in their own homes.
Or Seattle.
Are more than happy to give away images of themselves in social media. I don't know. It's an interesting one. But for enterprises, though, you know you need to think about it. And you know, in a world where GDPR exists and those kinds of things, you can't be slapdash about this anymore.
Yeah, and that's good. And that's a good point, Jay. And that's also good news, because the enterprise is probably where the stakes are highest.
Yep.
Right? That's where we can imagine systems where a catastrophic failure could really cost lives, or could cost massive disruption to society, or could cost huge amounts of money. And those are the places where there are security professionals who do try to stay up on this kind of thing. It's the kind of people who listen to this podcast. And those folks are able to choose security and are motivated to choose security. And I think that helps.
I think you're going to see a lot more of these kinds of stories where low-priced consumer electronics are being essentially hacked and harvested in the millions. You know, it's funny, you talked about a story that started in 2016. We've probably heard one of these every few weeks.
Yeah.
Like it anyway. And if you happen to go to, you know, the Black Hat conference or DEF CON or pick your favorite conference, you know, you could probably sit through an entire afternoon of research who just find these problems endlessly. And it's not really a ton of work because of the fact that we're not even finding weak security or these white hat guys aren't even having to hack anything. There's no security whatsoever. It's really something, Tim.
And this is maybe a good note to lead on, which is I'm actually going to turn that from something that maybe sounds a little pessimistic into something that's kind of optimistic, which is, in a way, this is good news that the most worrying vulnerability is very easily addressed. We understand what's wrong, and there is a straightforward path to making it right. And that's much better than a situation where everybody scratches his head and says, gee, I don't know what to do about it. So that's great, right? It means that it's just about education, elbow grease, some legislation, perhaps some amount of peer pressure, and those factors can make a difference.
I'll tell you right now, I think legislation's making people take notice. I think GDPR's making people take notice. And this might be the brightest light of all, Tim. There are consortiums out there that are putting real identity-based security technology at the center of IoT communication standards.
Absolutely. You bet there are. In lots of industries.
Lots and lots. So you were talking about things like the Open Connectivity Foundation for all kinds of devices, including consumer devices. You know, Aeromax for broadband communication on tarmacs. I could go on and on.
Yeah.
That may be one of the brightest lights, Tim, is that the really smart people that are out there that are behind interoperability, especially, they know they need security and they're doing it right.
Yeah, and maybe it's worth in a later podcast to dive into those consortia and what they're up to, because I think there's a lot of interesting content there. But this is probably a great place to leave it today. Thank you so much, as always, for your insights, Jay.
It's great to be here, Tim.